some of our Unitarian Universalist principles seem like very iffy propositions. Take our belief in the inherent worth of all people. I can think of plenty of people whose actions seem to refute this proposition. Of course, Hitler is the one that always comes to mind first. But despite lots of contradictory evidence, I maintain that all people do have inherent worth. And this, my friends, is called a leap of faith. But here's a UU principle that seems to be a lot less iffy. It is this belief that we are part of an interdependent web. I think what we just heard sung so beautifully. Plenty of religions, Buddhism, many Native American spiritualities, for example, affirm the same idea. Sometimes I think we feel like we must have invented this as Unitarian Universalists. We didn't. Lots of other folks believe this too. And science continues to add heaps of evidence supporting this proposition that everything, everyone is interdependent, interrelated. So to me, this seems like a self-evident truth, a basic fact about the nature of existence. And in general, the greater and the deeper our awareness of this fact, the better our chances of being able to live ethical, good lives. Deeply comprehending this truth can, for example, help us be compassionate, and not just to people we know, but to people we don't know as well. The frightened refugee fleeing Syria, the Filipina struggling to cope in the aftermath of the devastating typhoon, the malnourished child in our own country, we are connected to these folks. We are interrelated. We are family. This insight of connection can, doesn't always, but it can lead to compassionate action. Well, because of modern communication technology, we are so much more vividly connected to exponentially more people today than 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. So now we can see that frightened Syrian refugee on our TV or our tablet or our computer. We can see the devastation of the typhoon. We might even see a story about a malnourished child in America, though that is a little harder to see. We hear constantly about the plight of people we don't know, but to whom our faith and science remind us we are intimately related. Just a few generations ago, we would not have been so vividly connected to people on the other side of the world, or the town, or our block. So this is a good thing, to a point. It helps us feel and hopefully act compassionately toward people we don't know, but the sheer volume of these stories can be overwhelming. We can feel like we are drowning in stories of strangers' suffering. And when that happens, compassion fatigue can set in. Instead of figuring out how we can at least help a few people in our own small way, we wallow in despair, we feel numb, we feel immobilized. So how should we deal with what I've dubbed human suffering overload syndrome? And I did make that up. I looked on Google. No one else has used that. So human suffering overload syndrome. This to me is one of the most intense spiritual questions we have in this plugged-in age we live in. Well, I got a possible hint of an answer one day during my sabbatical. I was walking through Tavistock Square in London with a friend. And as I was walking along, I happened to notice an oval-shaped plaque on a fence next to the sidewalk, maybe 2-3 feet wide. My friend didn't even notice it. The plaque read, "In memory of those who were killed in the bomb attack on the Route 30 bus near this spot on 7th July 2005, London will not forget them and all those who suffered that day." And then the plaque listed the people who died on that number 30 bus, and it had a simple sprig from a tree. That's it. To refresh your memory, on that day in 2005, three bombs ripped through the underground, different spots, and then the fourth bomb went off on this number 30 bus. Now I knew where that happened. And all suicide bombers that day killed 52 other people and wounded over 700. 7-7, as British people call that day, of course is not the magnitude of death of 9-11, but it's much more than a minor terrorist event. The public transit system in London is the lifeblood of that city, and so that attack was designed to sow maximum mayhem as well as fear. Well, seeing that little memorial, it instantly occurred to me that, by American standards, that's a pretty understated memorial. So I wonder why. Maybe it's an example of that stiff upper lip that British people are supposed to have. Maybe, and this speaks more to me, maybe it's evidence of a coping strategy that the British people developed during this last century, where they've had an overload of human suffering to contend with. I was deeply struck while I was there about the prominent place of World War I in the British psyche. So Britain lost 1 million people, close to it, in World War I. 1 in 50, in fact, in that country died in the war, compared to 1 in 1,000 here in the United States. No wonder we've forgotten that war. But there, it's so present in a way that not even World War II is. But we know, World War II, 25 years later, they had the heck bombed out of them. And then there were the numerous attacks during the decades-long conflict over Northern Ireland. Maybe understating memorials is a way that the British people are choosing to deal with all of this suffering. Whatever the cause, it is certainly a different approach to mass human suffering. So, how can we deal with human suffering overload syndrome? Well, this suggests one way, which is to understate memorials. Another way, more radical, is simply to opt out, to withdraw, to construct a bubble around us so that we don't know what's going on beyond our little circle. In a sense, this is a retreat to a childlike innocence. Most of us, if we have the ability, if we're lucky enough, we try to shield our kids from at least some of the stories of mass human suffering. I know my wife and I did that with our kids with the Oklahoma City bombing and 9-11. We didn't want them to feel overwhelmed by this thing that they couldn't even begin to comprehend. My parents did the same thing for me. I was 5 years old in 1968, that tumultuous year, and I have a vague memory that something was going on, but I didn't hear specifically about assassinations, about riots, about police violence. My parents' carefully constructed bubble shielded me from all of that. When, as adults, we choose to withdraw in the face of human suffering overload syndrome, then we, in a sense, reconstruct that bubble of childhood innocence. Buddhism offers a mythological picture. What does this look like? Well, it looks like the Buddha in the story growing up in his parents' fabulous palace, and his parents making every step to make sure he never encountered any form of human suffering. Eventually, though, he felt such a deep need to find out what the world was really like, to see it as it really was. And so he fled that palace, never to return. And this story points to the problem with the bubble, which is that it is not real. When we get into that bubble and we never emerge, then we are living denial. It's a form of denial. In a way, though, as I think about the Buddha's life, he did return metaphorically to that palace in adulthood on occasion. This is what he did when he took retreats. He disconnected from the world around him, but then, and this is the big thing, he reconnected. He went back to the world around him beyond those palace walls. The point was not the retreat. The point was to refresh, to gain insight, and then return to the world, hopefully better equipped to respond to suffering. And so to me, this suggests a way to deal with human suffering overload syndrome. It is occasionally to retreat from it, not to escape for good, but to take breaks, and then to return to do our own small part to help make things better. And so to me, this is kind of a middle path between drowning, taking on, drowning in all the world's suffering on the one hand, and on the other hand, erecting this bubble around us. So this is what Thich Nhat Hanh did in the reading that Margaret shared. On 9/12/2001, he and his followers went to the beach. They escaped from the news, from the horrible images of death and destruction, and they let the beauty of nature and the beauty of community offer them some refreshment, some nourishment. And then they returned to the world, and they got about the business of helping to heal the hurting world. Thich Nhat Hanh replicated this in many when he'd step out in the midst of all of his activities post 9/11 to do a walking meditation. Taking a Sabbath day each week is another way to take a refreshing retreat from this world of suffering. Part of the discipline of the Sabbath is unplugging, turning off the screen, unplugging from the news. It's a chance to be fully in the company of ourselves, family, friends, and nature. It's a chance to spend a day, metaphorically, in the Buddha's childhood palace. And then we leave the palace. We return to our regular life, hopefully recharged, and a week later we repeat the cycle. What a wonderful way to work retreat and rejuvenation into our weekly schedule. A sabbatical, if you're lucky enough to get one, and I was, is another way to do this. And part of what I intentionally did on my sabbatical for 4 months was disconnect from American news. I'm kind of a news junkie, so this was not that easy. And I didn't completely disconnect, but I made sure there was a distance from it, a detachment from it. So I heard while I was gone that there was a government shutdown. And instead of wallowing in the angst of that, I looked at the situation with some detachment. Like a lot of British people, I suspect, I kind of looked at it and shook my head in puzzlement and thought, wow, that's interesting and weird. And then I went on with my life. And I invested zero emotion, zero angst in the shutdown. Now, I know the shutdown hurt people. I have a brother who works for the government. I don't deny that. But I was figuratively at the beach. And that's okay, because now my sabbatical is over. I am re-engaging emotionally and intellectually with the problems facing America. But hopefully, because of my sabbatical experience, I will be a little less likely to wallow in the angst and the despair of it all, to drown in the news. Hopefully, I will have a sort of engaged detachment to this news that goes on around us. So spiritual practices like retreats, walking meditations, observing the Sabbath, going on a sabbatical, if we're attentive, even spending a day at the beach, these all can help us find that middle path through the spiritual challenge of dealing with the human suffering overload syndrome. These practices can allow us to erect temporarily this childhood-like bubble around us, and then to go back out refreshed. Our worship and learning theme this month is innocence. And so with this focus, we lift up innocence as a spiritual value for Unitarian Universalists. And what I want to say is, sort of, it's sort of a good spiritual value, but not completely. So I do want to lift up the momentary innocence that comes with this bubble. But I don't want to lift up that we need to all erect this bubble and just retreat and get away from it all forever. Maybe a better way to frame the spiritual response to the human suffering overload syndrome is to talk about a fusion, seeking to approach the world with a childlike, imaginative, playful innocence, along with an adult eyes wide open perspective. The spiritual challenge is to find a balance between those two. In one of his books, Jack Kornfield tells the story, a great story from the artist James McNeill Whistler. And it, to me, the story illustrates this fusion beautifully. The story shows that what we need is this childlike innocence combined with the adult eyes wide open perspective. And that when we don't succeed in finding that middle path, in a sense, there can be a spiritual death. So the story comes from Whistler's West Point years. He went to West Point, the military academy, and he was in an engineering class. The professor, a lieutenant, instructed the class to each person to do a careful study of a bridge, a drawing of a bridge. So Whistler did a beautifully detailed stone arch with two kids fishing from the bridge. The lieutenant yelled at him, "This is a military exercise. Get those kids off the bridge." So Whistler went back, redid the drawing. Now there's the beautiful stone arch and two kids fishing on the bank by the bridge. "No, get those kids out of the picture." So the last revision has the bridge, the river, and two small tombstones next to the river.